is time to put away the bias, the lies, and deceit and bring forth real talk from real people about real news. Providing the out loud truth and capturing the essence of a new generation all in a fast-paced hour. This is Viewpoint This Sunday.
Welcome to another Viewpoint This Sunday. This is Malcolm Out Loud. Immigration reform, top of the list of Biden energy policies. The Texas freeze debacle, you see that. Perseverance is on Mars. And vaccine controversies, well, there is lots to talk about. Well, let me start here, and I want to ask you right up front, what do the following words mean to you? And not like the brazen giant of Greek fame, with conquering limbs astride from land to land, here at our sea-washed sunset gates shall stand a mighty woman with a torch whose flame is the imprisoned lightning, and her name, mother of exiles, from her beacon hand glows worldwide welcome, her mild eyes command. There bridged harbor that twin cities frame, keep ancient lands your storied pomp, cries she, with silent lips. Give me your tired, your poor, your huddled masses yearning to breathe free, the wretched refuse of your teeming shore. Send these, the homeless, tempest toast to me. I lift my lamp beside the golden door. Let's start up front here with immigration and bring on here, Mark Krikorian is here. And Mark, you've certainly heard of him and seen him before. He is the executive director of the Center for Immigration Studies. Been there since 1995. Now, CIS, in fact, it is really the premier immigration organization in the country, as far as I can see, and CIS.org. It's an independent, nonpartisan research organization in Washington, D.C. And of course, they are always on the story of immigration here, what's taking place. Now, Mark, the words of Emma Lazarus there, which I say right up front there, were written in 1883, the new Colossus. It, I think about everybody should know that this was a gift from France and was back in 1883. It was actually a ceremony held there in July 4th, 1884, dedicated here in 1886 in October in the United States. Now, what I want to start is, there was an interesting piece in The Atlantic in January 2018 that said this, Mark. Lines 10 and 11 of the poem are quoted with the most frequency. Give me your tired, your poor, your huddled masses, yearning to breathe free. And often by those aiming to highlight a contrast between a Lazarus' humanitarian vision of the nation and President Trump's racist rhetoric. And that's where, of course, a lot of the media was on all of this. Talk to me about how that's framed there in The Atlantic with, as they call, racist rhetoric versus immigration. And this gets into the context of immigration, legal and illegal, of course. Talk to us.
Well, there's two things to talk about here. First of all, government policy shouldn't be based on fundraising poems from the 19th century, because that's what this was. The poem was a fundraising vehicle for the American money to build the pedestal of the Statue of Liberty. The French sent the statue, we raised the money and built the pedestal. So first point is that, I mean, it's, you know, you don't base policy on 150-year-old doggerel. Secondly, the world has changed since we had an immigration policy like that in the 1880s. We have a modern post-industrial economy. Communications and transportation are much cheaper and faster and easier than they ever were in the past. The whole world has changed. Circumstances have changed, and policy needs to change in response. So this is, you know, this constant quoting of Emma Lazarus's poem is really more a surrender or an attempt to impose sentimentality on immigration policymaking rather than looking at the balancing the various interests, who benefits, who's harmed, who wins, who loses, and then coming up through the democratic process with an immigration policy that reflects all those you know, conflicting and different interests.
Mm-hmm. And a lot of people don't realize it really was to raise funds for the pedestal. That's exactly what that was about. I've mimicked this many times on national radio, talked about it. And I start there, Mark, because I think it's important in these arguments and discussions before we get into policy and we break things down that we understand the conversation and the abstract. What are we really talking about? So thank you for putting that into really context that is very proper. Ian, there's a big difference today what we're dealing with than the colonialism back of from European settlers and what had happened in America. But obviously there's an agenda and a mission here for many people who have other concepts and ideas of an America they view. And most people don't realize the consequences of these immigration policies. Let's start and talk about this big immigration reforms. It's called the U.S. Citizenship Act of 2021. So let me ask you this. What is the biggest surprise, if there is one, thus far in the Biden immigration proposals that he's put forth?
Well, there's three basic elements of the bill, of Biden's amnesty bill, and two of them are not surprising, and one of them is. So first, the not surprising part is that it tries to amnesty every illegal alien. It was a little surprising in that the cutoff date is January 1st of this year. So it's not even an amnesty for people who have put down roots and had kids and what have you. It's for anybody who got here a month and a half ago. But again, the amnesty part, that's sort of what you expect. The second part that doesn't surprise me much is that it hugely increases legal immigration. We're not even sure exactly how much because there's so many moving parts. And in fact, even the sponsors of the bill admitted that they hadn't even taken into account how much it would increase immigration. But it looks like maybe doubling legal immigration from 1 million a year to 2 million a year. Again, as appalling as that is from my point of view, it's not that surprising because that's what the Gang of Eight bill, for instance, did. The third part is what surprised me, and that is there is no enforcement in this bill. In fact, if anything, it weakens existing immigration enforcement going forward. And that's surprising because all the past bills like this, the Gang of Eight bill under Obama, if any of your listeners remember that, under Bush, there was an attempt by Ted Kennedy and John McCain to do a big amnesty bill. All of those bills, they failed, of course, and they were bad. They should have failed, but they all at least pretended to increase enforcement in the future after the amnesty so that we wouldn't have another illegal population grow up and have to amnesty them. This bill is radical. I wouldn't even say surprising. It's radical in that it rejects the very idea of enforcing immigration laws better in the future and essentially guarantees a new illegal population 5 or 10 years down the road.
You either are under the philosophy, okay, what do all these immigrants do to the quality of life for people who are living here now? I mean, do they benefit us? Do they build life in some other way? Or do we have an obligation to the world? And this is really where it gets a little touchy to people, Mark, because are we really the doormat to the world? And that's kind of how I see that whole liberty thing with the humanitarian aspect. Is that our goal and aspirations to what our gift to the world is? Or should we have some responsible immigration policies? Isn't that where the argument really is, Mark?
I think so. At base, you're right. And the way I put it is that there are two sides here. One thinks that everyone in the world has the right to come here.
Exactly.
And we can stop only those who are obviously, you know, terrorists or murderers, or they have Ebola or something like that. That everyone else can decide on their own to come here and we're not allowed to keep them out. The other perspective, which frankly is what the law is based on and what, you know, 99% of anybody you stop on the street would say, is that no one has the right to come here. But we then make exceptions for certain people. You know, you marry a foreigner, you of course get to bring that person here, that sort of thing. So either everybody gets to come in with a few exceptions, that's the other side of the debate, or no one gets to come in unless we make exceptions and let them in. When you get right down to it, that's really what this whole debate is about.
So if they can't get it through with the Republicans stopping it, do they go another way? How focused are they on this immigration? It seems to me it's one of the big policies he's really trying to push in the early days here. My guess is they're very focused on this. What do you see happening?
They're definitely focused on getting something on immigrants, basically some amnesty through Congress. But this big bill, this Biden-Menendez amnesty bill,
right,
I think is more kind of like a shiny object to get everybody to focus on, because the Democrats have been pretty open, even talking about it in the press, that they are thinking about at the same time you pulling pieces of this big bill out and trying to get those across the finish line. And those would not be small amnesties. This would be an amnesty for the so-called dreamers, the people with DACA, and then a whole bunch of other people, mm-hmm. as well as for farm workers and others. It would add up to maybe 3 to 4 million people getting amnesty. Those are the supposed small pieces that they're, I think, planning on really pushing through. That would be more people, more illegal immigrants amnesty than happened back in the 1980s when President Reagan signed that first big amnesty. And again, the whole point of the deal was there, we would fix people's problems who were already here, but make sure we didn't get more illegal immigration in the future. That was a bait and switch. It was a lie. It didn't work. And what the Democrats are going to do now, even with these piecemeal amnesties, is just have an amnesty, again, with no enforcement. So they're just going to argue a few years from now, we need to have another amnesty bill because of all these other illegal immigrants that have come in since the last amnesty. So my point is, this big bill is, I won't say it's a distraction, that's not really the right word, but it's an attempt to, it really does show what they really want, but they've decided that because they have such tiny majorities in both houses of Congress, they're gonna go for something less. I think they're still gonna fail, but at least that's a plausible strategy from their perspective.
So you think they'll fail? You don't think this, even no matter how, because they're very clever, the left is, very much so with getting these kinds of things. They always find another path or another way forward. But you don't, at the end of the day, you don't see them accomplishing what they really want to accomplish with immigration then?
I think not. Now, you know, I could be wrong. I mean, you know, my opinion and $4 will get you a cup of coffee at Starbucks, but it is, they think it's kind of guaranteed. They look at polls that say, for instance, illegal immigrants who came here as kids and who are adults now, right, should be legalized, that the public supports that. Well, you know, under certain circumstances, I support it.
That's right.
But if any poll that has me and say AOC or Biden giving the same answer is asking the wrong question. Because if you ask people, do you want young people who came here as babies, spent their whole lives here, to be able to stay legally? Most people will say, yeah, sure, that sounds, you know, I mean, I don't like the fact that their parents managed to come here illegally, but, you know, yeah, sure, it seems like a merciful, prudent thing to do. But if you ask, do you want to do that without any provision for trying to limit future people in this situation, no enforcement? If you ask them, do you think their parents should also benefit since the parents were adults and they knew what they were doing? You're going to get a very different answer. Mm-hmm. And so anyway, my point is, I think the Democrats have come to believe their own press releases about how popular they are. And I think they're going to be in for a rude surprise.
Yeah, I really like the way you put that out there. It's, you know, I call it compassionate conservatism, Mark. And you're right with everything you're saying. I appreciate that, because we always want to do the right things. I mean, that is very much first and foremost. And I always want to remind people of that, because, you know, there's a public persona put out there from the media elites and the oligarchs that suggest otherwise, that heartless is at the center of this thing. The difference in the policies of the Democrats that you're speaking about now is they look at immigration, I think, and tell me if this is in the right context here, but my guess is they're looking at this as really a doormat to the U.S., a responsibility, but to really new voters. Is that the context we're looking at this from their angle?
I think it's a combination of things. It's partly new voters, mm-hmm. and not to get on a tangent, but this bill has like several pieces of amnesty, mm-hmm. and one of them for these so-called dreamers and the farm workers and what have you would enable these people, would give these people citizenship within 3 years. I'm pretty sure that shortly after that 3 year period, there's some important like election thing that's coming up. So, yeah. So this is, I mean, part of it is out openly about voters, but it's also about money, because there are different interest groups that make money off of immigration, not just cheap labor employers, there That's is right. that too, but immigration lawyers, even the left-wing advocacy groups get government grants and foundation grants to help people who are here illegally, or immigrants in general. So the more there are, the more money they get. And then more broadly, and this is the point I brought up earlier, is there sort of a philosophical mm-hmm. belief that everybody in the world has a right to come here. So if you put all those things together, that's a pretty powerful package for their side.
Well, that's a recipe for disaster is what that is. And, and the path to citizenship, basically, this is, as you say, aggressive. You could use the word for some radical as well. But the problem is not so much what's here already. It's what they're encouraging for the future is the debate. Let's be clear. That's really the debate is immigration policies as a whole. At some point, if you don't cut this off at the pass, Mark, we're never going to fix the problem. And we're going to do damage to future generations to the extreme degree that I don't think people realize the pain and really what's this Pandora box that is being opened in right now is far more serious than people think. You agree with that?
Oh, yeah, I think so. I mean, clearly, this amnesty bill is not intended to be the end of anything. Right. It's the beginning of prying open the borders further and further. This is really this is their opening gambit. This is the start of what they really want on immigration. This is not sort of a closing chapter. For these guys, this isn't the last chapter. This is the first chapter.
See, that's an important point. People need to hear what Mark says right there. This is so important what he's saying there, because this is, again, the opening gambit, as he says, is not the final conclusion. I want to get your thoughts on the wall itself. What are you hearing in your circles about the wall? Are they going to take existing down? Are they leaving that up? They're certainly not going to build anymore. Whatever's been done has been done. He's already redirected funds and stopped everything. Any word on that, what you hear?
Yeah, I mean, the president stopped construction on further construction on the wall as soon as he took over. And in fact, it's going to cost us a lot of money because we are going to have to pay the contractors for not building the wall. In other words, because they have contracts and it's going to be, it's all like paying farmers not to grow food. We're going to end up having to pay these guys not to build the wall. But I don't think they're going to be taking any of it down. The ACLU has actually filed lawsuits to demand that the wall actually be demolished.
Yeah.
But Biden, you know, as much as his cognitive capacities have declined, he's not that much of an idiot. He's been a politician for a long time, and he understands that taking parts of the wall down is almost like filming Republican campaign ads for free. So, and he's said, no, we're not going to be taking any of it down. So, but you know, that puts some people in difficult situations. There's a rancher, for instance, in New Mexico, where the wall is being built on his land, and from two separate ends, it's coming together. And there's like a 3/4 mile gap that they didn't finish. Well, that's now a hole in the wall that people are going to be funneled through right onto his ranch. So even stopping the wall construction is going to create problems for people at the border.
Right. Yeah. Real world impacts here for sure. You know, that's the best compliment I heard on Joe Biden in quite some time, actually, Mark. But not as much of an idiot as he could. That's terrific. That's a good way to size that up anyways here. Mark Gregorian, the Center for Immigration Studies. Mark, thank you for being here and starting the program off here. CIS.org is all there. You guys are doing incredible work. And Mark, thank you wholeheartedly for all all the work you do in this country. You've been on the front lines of immigration. Well, it's kind of taken over your life, hasn't it, buddy?
It has indeed for 25 years now.
I know it has. You're one of the best voices in the country on it. Thank you again here. So as we come up next, friends, we're going to take a scientific look at this energy policies of Biden, the Texas freeze, and what do you think about perseverance on Mars? More Viewpoint in just a moment.
The America Out Loud Talk Radio app is on Android or Apple. It's the perfect way to listen in to the new generation of talk shows and hosts who are ready to inform and inspire.
Well, my fellow Americans, how did you feel watching footage on the news of domestic terrorists looting our stores and burning our cities down? You were probably disgusted and angry as much as I was. It's disturbing what's going on. Well, you'd be shocked to know that your shopping habits are supporting these extremists. Companies like Amazon, Nike, Disney, FedEx, it's an endless list. And they've been supporting these radical groups. Let's stop supporting companies that fund these extremist groups. We can all do our part. Visit shoptotheright.com and you'll find businesses in a nationwide database and companies that are aligned with our American values. Visit shoptotheright.com and let's all make a difference. Well, as we join you back on Viewpoint, I would be amiss not to remind you that we are coming up on our 5-year anniversary at America Out Loud. It's hard to imagine that 5 amazing years have already flown by. And of course, we are babies in this entire media empire out there. We are babies, but we have a bright future as we really spotlight patriotism and conservative values here as a network on America Out Loud. Now, this will come up in April. We have a lot in planned, a lot of changes in store, and a lot of things will happen on the platform. You'll be hearing some guest hosting for me on a Viewpoint on my daily program, The Voice of a Nation. I will be stepping off the air for a few weeks. This is the first time I've done that in the 5 years. And so just as a reminder, if you don't hear my voice in there, you'll know why. And we are preparing and planning for the next 5 years. And we look forward to bringing all that to you. Now, let's talk about the energy piece, the Biden policies on that, the Texas freeze and Mars and all the good stuff here. And we'll do that now with Dr. Jay Lehrer is here. He's a senior policy analyst with the International Climate Science Coalition and former science director of the Heartland Institute. Tom Harris is here. He's the executive director of the Ottawa, Canada-based International Climate Science Coalition. Two of the smartest guys I know. And we'll put a feather in your cap, guys. So let's start with the Texas freeze. And there's a lot to this story, man. Wow, with the energy thing. And it's, let me just go through a couple of points with you guys and let's see if we can't bring people up to speed. So the wind turbines were frozen, unable to generate the power. Now, here's what I'm hearing. As it's put out there in some editorial, guys, the fossil fuel crowd has wasted no time in seizing this as an opportunity to show how renewables are unreliable and limited. Renewable supporters, on the other hand, have been quick to point out that natural gas pipelines are frozen, refineries have shut down, and millions of barrels of crude oil production have been shut in. Fossil fuel loyalists are using this as a platform for warning the world against the horrors of what would be the Green New Deal, while the renewables crowd is rallying around what they see as proof that we need the Green New Deal now. Now, this was in a Texas newspaper. Dr. Jay Lehrer, what do you make of all that?
Well, I have to say that while I feel badly for the 4.5 million people out of power in Texas, this is the greatest thing that could have happened to show the American citizen that Biden's energy plan is a disaster and it's the best thing that could happen to all the Republicans that will be running in 500 House seats and a third of the Senate seats, because it proves that wind and solar is the cause of this disaster. The solar plans are all covered with snow. The wind turbines are iced, and they are responsible for shutting down many of our gas pipelines that are absolutely required to back up 100% every bit of the wind and solar power they put on their grid. So it's really We couldn't have planned it, again, not wanting to hurt the people without power, but it should be proof to the rest of the country that you cannot run any kind of an economy on wind and solar. They should not be calling them renewables. They should be calling them unreliables. And this is a disaster, but it will be echoed and repeated all over the country. And we're going to see rolling blackouts across the country during Mr. Biden's administration. And that's good for the country because they will have had enough of it 18 months down the road. And when the next election cycle comes in 2 years, they're going to be out of power because of this.
So what's happened now is you've got, Tom, you've got water pipes are frozen. I mean, they're just not prepared for this sort of thing in Texas with temperatures that sunk below zero in blizzard conditions and so on and so forth. Texas Governor Greg Abbott, he issued an order that prevented all natural gas producers to stop selling to anyone outside of Texas. And that order was put into place through the next couple of days here. And it will cause a crisis in some other areas, including Mexico, where a lot of this stuff goes. So it's sort of a blame game. Now, as I was telling folks on my daily program, Tom, they have their own grid there in Texas, ERCOT. And it's a separate grid from the western east part of the United States, very interestingly enough. And that grid went bad. The Texas Attorney General Ken Paxton is demanding answers. So there's a lot of blame game going around there for sure. What's your take of all, Tom, from this Texas freeze and debacle down there?
Well, one of the things that's most interesting is Biden has had to actually ship diesel generators to Texas because of their use of wind and alternative energy. It wasn't adequate. So, in fact, in the short term, you're seeing a lot of pollution from these diesel generators. So this is another factor, is that the net result of wind and solar power is very likely to be a lot more pollution, not less. And of course, the cost to people's livelihoods and, you know, the fact that some people died apparently due to carbon monoxide poisoning, probably falling asleep in their cars when they were freezing in their homes. One of the troubles, Malcolm, is they don't have much in the way of insulation. You know, here in Canada, we're used to that sort of thing. So even if we do have a power outage, it's a long time before our houses get cold.
Exactly.
But they don't have that insulation. They're not used to it.
Yeah, no, they're not at all. I mean, that's exactly, they're ill-prepared. But then again, you know, Tom, what I get out of this kind of is that's the whole essence of climate changing. The climates are supposed to change. I mean, there were no guarantees on this blue marble that the climate would stay the same. I mean, just look at the rest of the planetary bodies and we're blessed. So what they've made is a gazillion dollar business and industry out of it, which we argue and debate about all the time. John Kerry, you know, certain thoughts come to your mind when I say that name, but he is the White House special envoy. He's the czar, the climate change czar, if you will. We're back to czars in D.C. So he warned that on Friday here, the U.S. has less than a decade left before the worst of the climate catastrophe. Around 2030 is the date at which we have to get the world now on the right path in order to cap the level of warming at the level of 1.5 degrees Celsius, he said. And then he says this, the scientists told us 3 years ago we had 12 years to avert the worst consequences of climate crisis. 3 years have been wasted. We got 9 years left. There's no more room for BS anymore. There's no faking it on this one. This is what he says. How do you respond to that, Tom?
Well, it's funny he'd say no more room for BS because all of what he said is BS. You know, the interesting thing is we're almost at the 1.5 degree mark already. I mean, since 1880, temperatures have risen on average about 1 degree, a little over 1 degree Celsius. So it doesn't look like an emergency to me. You know, it's interesting. If you look at all the actual real world data, three times as many polar bears in the Arctic now as there were in the 60s. You know, sea level rising about 7 inches per century, as it always has in recent decades. So what? You know, the pH of the ocean is not abnormal. So, you know, what we've got here is, quite frankly, to use John Kerry's terms, a lot of BS.
Jay, I could just hear you in my ear before you even said a word.
You're so right. This is the biggest fraud in the history of the world. And its intention isn't to restrain the temperature of the planet. Its intention ultimately is to make all energy rationable. The government wants to be in charge of all energy. They know you can't supply the country on wind and solar. They want to do away with fossil fuel. So they will tell you how much energy you can use. Essentially, they want to make the entire population dependent on the government. And it's important for the listeners of Viewpoint to understand what I'm about to say. Man's impact on the temperature of the planet is zero. It's not a little bit. It's not a lot. It is zero. Unfortunately, there's a cottage industry of scientists that try to figure out that it is something, even though it's three or four zeros to the right of the decimal. It may be a hundred thousandths of a degree or two ten-thousandths of a degree. It's useless to keep trying to figure out something that you have to default to zero. So this is such a fraud. It's amazing. But the intention is to enslave the population and make them totally dependent on the government for their energy.
Zero is a big number, actually, in this debate, in this discussion. But as you think about that and ponder that a moment, Tom, let me also say to you that on the Paris Agreement, which the United States is rejoining, Kerry says, even if we did everything that we said we were going to do when we signed up in Paris, we would see a rise in the Earth's temperature to somewhere around 3.7 degrees. Where's he getting this from, Tom? Do you have any idea?
I suppose if you search the world for the craziest scientist on the planet, you can probably find somebody who'll say that. But, you know, I agree with Jay. I mean, I used to talk about fractions of a degree until Jay pointed out that the uncertainty in the measurement is greater than the amount they say that warming is going to occur by in many cases. And when they're constantly setting records, I mean, you say, oh, global temperature was hotter last year than at any time in 150 years. Well, first of all, the Earth's a little older than 150 years. And in fact, you know, for a lot of Earth's history, we are far, far warmer than today with far higher carbon dioxide levels than today. And the Earth did very, very well. And, you know, one thing we have to realize, Malcolm, is that it's cold. And Texas is demonstrating this very well right now. It's cold that is bad for humans and civilization. It's not warm. I mean, during the warm periods, we had very, well, you know, they call them a climate optimum, for example, right. The time when it was warmest since the last ice age.
Right. One listener wrote into his gentleman and said this, Jay said, let me read you his quote here, Charles. He says, Biden and the left are not pushing this for the reliability, the good of climate or mankind. They are in the business of stealing money, contracts for friends, backers, and family members, Paris Climate Accord, etc. Ever wonder why they are so hip to ship our tax dollars out of country? It is easier to launder money back to your friends, family, and self outside the country. Follow the money for the real deal. What do you say to that, Jay?
I say that it is very articulate and precisely accurate. This is a crime administration. All they want to do is enrich themselves with money, but more importantly, with power. The administration as a whole is basically a crime family like the days of the Casa Nostra many decades ago. And they've taken over, and all they want to do is use our nation and really the world as their bank for money and power. And we simply can't let them. And the way we try to explain to people is through your platform in America Out Loud of what the truth is. And since they've chosen climate change, it's important for people to know our impact on climate is absolutely zero. And that, in fact, carbon dioxide is why we live here. It's a good thing. Our planet, our standard of living will improve if we go from 420 parts per million of carbon dioxide to 500 and 600. They're laying out, they're doing so many things that are going to harm such a large percentage of the population that come the next election cycle, people are going to wake up and we're going to take back the power of our government.
All right. So let me remind everybody that Dr. Jay Laird, Tom Harris have a terrific must read 3-part series on climate change on AmericaOutloud.com. It is absolutely worth all of your time to not only read, but share out there. These guys know what they're talking about. 3-part series. You'll see it if you go under on the navigation bar columnist and just look up Dr. Jay Laird, Tom Harris. You'll get all 3 parts and you'll see the latest on the front page as well. And I got to read you this here on the first opening article. They have the Surgeon General's warning. Reading President Joe Biden's climate change executive order may cause nausea, clinical depression and thoughts of immediate suicide, part one of a three-part series. Isn't that nice opening for that? So anyways, you got to read that series there, and you'll be educated with everything you really need to know. Now, let me talk to you guys about Mars, Perseverance here. Tom, after safely landing on the surface of Mars, this happened on Thursday, was a big, big day. Perseverance rover, the picture showed it coming down on the planet. Very, very cool stuff. NASA says the team is overwhelmed with excitement and joy to have successfully landed a rover on the surface of Mars. This is the most aggressive experiment to date here. Which will really impact the way we see Mars in the future. Pretty big deal, Tom, huh?
Oh, yeah. In fact, it's quite amazing to look at the different experiments they have on this. For example, they have actually two microphones. We're going to hear the winds of Mars. We see that they're actually sending samples of spacesuits and space helmets on this spacecraft to Mars. It's actually going to be tested to see how well it responds to the Martian environment. They have something called MOXIE, which produces oxygen from the Martian carbon dioxide atmosphere. And that, of course, will be crucial for future space colonists on Mars and also for making rocket fuel. They have a weather station. They have subsurface radar, ground penetrating radar to look for water under the surface. This is an amazing little spacecraft.
Yeah, but do they have a drive-through for McDonald's yet, do you know?
Well, they're about the same size as a car. So it's much bigger than many of the older ones. But yeah, this is getting ready for the first human flight, which, as Jay say, is not going to be by 2030.
Yeah. I'm excited about this stuff. Jay, I am so enthralled. You know, I wish I could have multiple lives, Jay, because quite frankly, I'd love to be a NASA scientist in one of those lives. This stuff really excites me, and my patriotism even gets higher and higher when I see what we can do as a country. What do you think about this, Mars? Give me your thoughts.
Well, I think that it's the kind of thing like when we landed people on the moon. It was an uplifting for the whole nation. And this current experience should also be uplifting for the whole nation. And it's a shame that we have this horrible administration that's redirecting our concerns to be afraid of things, to be scared. They want to scare. They scared us more than necessary with the pandemic. They're scaring us 100-fold more than necessary with climate change. We should be focusing on our country as the adventurers we have always been. And I think this landing of a new rover is part of what I think I'm going to be able to do in creating optimism among the population that they are not going to take control of the country. We're going to take it back, and we're going to do more, spend more of our resources in space exploration and things that we learn so much that are just so uplifting. It just could not be better. The only sad thing is that we have NASA buying in with the climate change fraud in order to get more funding from the government. I wish that were not so.
That's interesting. That's an interesting caveat to throw out there. Big thank you here to Tom Harris, Dr. Jay Lehrer. Always love their contributions, and is just really part of our family here at America Out Loud and the work we're doing. We're excited about what's going to happen here in the next many years with our platform, and as we continue to get the word out there and to give hope back to this next generation and optimistic views that we'd like to put out there for America. So we thank you, friends, for being part of that. Up next, we got a very important segment coming up right next with Dr. Peter McCullough. This is about the vaccines now and the vaccination. Some information you really must hear. It's important what we'll talk about next. It's very highly, highly controversial. It's just the way it is, people. But like everything, got to pay attention to it, you know. Stay right there. We'll continue on with Viewpoints in just a moment.
We are the vision of the voices. You can email us at talk@americaoutloud.com.
Spreading the out loud truth from sea to shining sea. AmericaOutloud.com is the voice of liberty and justice for all. This is not a fight of Republican versus Democrat. It's not a fight of rich versus poor, old versus young, man versus woman, gay versus straight. It's not a fight of black lives, blue lives, Hispanic lives, or white lives. This is a battle of good versus evil. It's a fight for the soul of humanity. But we are the vision of the voices. America Out Loud Talk Radio. Well, surely there's a lot of miscommunication and information out there about vaccines. I feel compelled to try to get the record straight again and look at all sides of this discussion. Listen, I mean, the truth of it is, I've got people in my circle and very, very dear friends and others who have taken the vaccine. There are others who are not. And so you're either on one side of this discussion or the other side. It is a very polarizing, controversial topic for sure. But we'll try to do it some justice right now, friends, with Dr. Peter McCullough joins us. And he's an internist and cardiologist from Dallas, Texas. Been a leader in the pandemic response to the COVID-19 disaster from the very beginning. And also, he's been in the Senate hearings on COVID with Senator Ron Johnson. He's been on the forefront of a lot of these things. Great wisdom and intellect here, and happy to have Dr. McCullough here. Now, I want to start and do something a little different here. Let me read you this here, Dr. McCullough, that came out of the Health Impact News. And this was written, by the way, so everybody's on the same page as me, in December 2020. And I just thought it captured what a lot of people are feeling. And so let me say this, and then I want to give you the floor to go on this. So the headline on this got my attention. It said this: doctors around the world issue dire warning, do not get the COVID vaccine. In an effort to combat big pharma, corporate media, and big tech censorship, doctors around the world are frantically trying to warn the masses of the devastating effects of the experimental COVID vaccines about to be mass injected into the unsuspecting public assisted by military forces around the world. Doesn't give you the warm and fuzzy there, does it? And then says, what could possibly motivate these doctors, nurses, scientists, and other health professionals to make such an impassioned plea? Well, these are good questions here. What do they have to gain by taking the time to educate the public on the hidden dangers of a new class of vaccine about to be inflicted upon the citizens of countries around the world? And they answered it back and said they have nothing to gain and much to lose, including their careers and possibly even their lives. So then the bigger question is, why are they doing this? So that kind of put it in context a little bit for me, Dr. McCullough, to say, well, a lot of people really feel the way that is. Let me have you now help tell us where are we at and what your thoughts on this are, please.
Well, Malcolm, thanks for having me on the program, and the opinions I'll express are my own and not necessarily those of my institution. Certainly the COVID-19 pandemic has influenced all of our lives. Everyone has been, in a sense, an armchair epidemiologist looking at the outbreak curves and trying to understand them. Thankfully, we've had a third and final giant wave in the United States, and we're on the steep descent of that wave. The number of new cases going down, the hospitals are clearing out, the deaths are declining, and it looks like we're starting to see light at the end of the tunnel. Importantly, there are some calculations now of herd immunity. Herd immunity means that there's enough people out there who are now immune to the virus that, in fact, if the virus is contracted by one person, it's not going to spread in a multiplicative manner. And how the calculations go are as follows. There's a baseline assumption that not everybody can get COVID-19. This is important, and I think experts agree on this. It's about 15% of people we think are just naturally immune to COVID-19, maybe through cross immunity of other coronaviruses. Then there is the known number of people who have had the virus, so that's understood. And then there's a multiple that the Center for Disease Control has that indicates that of the number of people who've had the virus, and it's proven by testing, there's about six other people who have had it. They just haven't had the testing to prove it. They've been in the same household and they've been equally sick, etc. So when you apply that calculation right now, let me give you the top 10 states in the United States for herd immunity. Based on that, this has nothing to do with the vaccine. This is just the natural history of the pandemic. The top 10 states are North Dakota, 93% herd immunity. South Dakota, 90%. Iowa, 78%. Nebraska, 76%. Kansas, 75%. Wisconsin, 72%. Idaho, 71%. Montana, 69%. Minnesota, 65%. Michigan, 53%. The estimates are if you have over 60% of people who have this herd immunity, the virus isn't going to spread too far or too fast at that juncture. So I can tell you in those top 10 states, I anticipate there will be no more hospitalization crises. Certainly there can be small outbreaks, but it can be manageable. So you started out with the vaccine. What can the vaccine accomplish on top of 93% herd immunity? The answer is very little, but the vaccine does do something. We know from the Pfizer and Moderna vaccines, even though in each trial there were fewer than 100 cases of COVID, that the vaccines did cut down on the rate of the kind of mild viral upper respiratory tract symptoms of COVID. The Pfizer and Moderna vaccines did not prevent hospitalization or death. This is very important. They did not. But they did prevent this kind of mild form of illness, which would be like a cold. Now, the Johnson & Johnson vaccine, in my view, is much more impressive. That's going to be up for review next week by the U.S. FDA. There was 45,000 patients in that trial, and there were 468 cases of COVID-19. So four times as many as the Pfizer and Moderna vaccine. So a much more robust clinical trials program. Over a third enrolled were over age 60. Now, the overall protection rate with the Johnson & Johnson vaccine was 66% overall at 20 days. And you may think, well, that's not so impressive, but it was 85% protective against severe disease and 100% protective against hospitalization. And importantly, it was protective against some of the variants or some of the mutant forms of COVID-19. So many of my patients and my family members have been asking me about the vaccines. And I said, listen, if you're going to, you know, opt for a vaccine, certainly consult a doctor. And I think waiting for the J&J vaccine, since herd immunity is being achieved in so many states, is wise. Your initial statements have to do with safety, and we can turn our attention to safety briefly, but the safety is a concern with the Pfizer and Moderna vaccines, and I anticipate with the Johnson & Johnson vaccine, although their platform that the vaccine is manufactured on has much less side effects, it appears, than the messenger RNA vaccines. But let me say that the greatest safety concern is death, that a vaccination causing death, and the CDC vaccine adverse event reporting system, which is an open database, and I checked it right before this interview, as of February 20, 2021, there are 660 vaccine reported deaths in the database. 660.
Wow. Yeah, I mean, that's a striking number, is it not?
Well, if this was a new drug, and let's say we had a new drug for diabetes or a new drug for a prostate problem or a skin problem, and there were 660 deaths, I can tell you right now that drug would be off the market. In fact, it'd probably be off the market after about five deaths or get a black box warning. But we're at 660. Now, let me say, I've looked at some of the narratives. Remember, the person who dies can't report it, right? So it takes somebody else to go into the database and report it. And the majority of these are reported by nursing homes or senior homes. So someone's administering the vaccine and then the patient is dying and the healthcare worker is so concerned that they log into the CDC database and they report it. What about the individuals who are getting the vaccine and going home and dying? Who's going on the CDC database to report those deaths?
Right.
So at 660, that's extremely alarming. There have been calls now to Washington by many concerned doctors to say that we need an immediate, unbiased external review committee to see how many of these deaths are truly related to the vaccine. Now, someone could just die of natural causes, but let me give you a reference point. Right now, we are at 17 million fully vaccinated individuals in the United States and 660 deaths. Last year, we administered 194 million flu shots, and there were 23 deaths reported. And so what we're seeing now is, without a doctor's advice, without a doctor's order, people are signing up for this vaccine, signing the consent, indemnifying them, everybody involved, getting the vaccine. And for 660 people, they've lost their lives. They've actually lost their lives trying to prevent COVID-19, of which we can actually treat somebody with COVID-19 and reduce their mortality just with multi-drug treatment by 85%.
Yeah, the irony of what you say there is not lost on me, Dr. McCullough. That's my concern, what you just say right there. If it's a trade-off, you mentioned, I love those 10 markets you put out there, first of all, that was perfect. If it's a trade-off of taking, getting COVID or chancing the vaccine, like a lot of these people who've now lost their lives, I mean, it's a real gamble, isn't it? I mean, you're darned if you do, darned if you don't. How does really somebody make an educated decision?
It's very hard. It turns out the nursing home or senior home patients, they're the most vulnerable. And I can think of some patients and family members who I don't think they'd survive an hour or two with COVID-19. In fact, those are the people who are not going to survive with the vaccine either. Mm-hmm. So the best way to think about it is there's a narrow band of patients who probably are appropriate for the vaccine, where they have a lot of person-to-person contact. They themselves could spread it to others. So I do think nursing home workers should be vaccinated. I do think that's the case. There have been clear outbreaks of nursing home workers giving it to nursing home patients and then having the patients die. That's clearly happened. Hospital healthcare workers are low risk, even though they were the first to be vaccinated. There hasn't been outbreaks among nurses or young doctors to be concerned of. And then for the general public, who's been basically sheltering at home and under various forms of lockdowns, they're very low risk. And what I've told some patients is that, listen, you've done so well for so long. Mm-hmm. At this point in time, it becomes less compelling. The vaccine, as I gave you these numbers, mm-hmm. if we've had 28 million Americans with COVID. We have 168 million who've had COVID, we suspect, and just haven't had the test. And we've only vaccinated 17 million. The vaccine is not going to contribute to resolution of the crisis.
Even though the political operatives have suggested it would. Let me get that out there, Dr. Mab. They have absolutely suggested it would do that. And that's a false narrative that's been put onto the American people. And that irritates me.
Well, I think it is completely false. And the nice thing about these epidemic curves, you can see them falling before anybody was fully vaccinated. So rates of hospitalization were plummeting before anybody even got their second vaccine shot. So one can't claim the vaccine is going to do much from a public health perspective, but we're hearing another false narrative that I want to address, and that is it's a race against time, that the variants or the mutant forms of the virus are going to come, and we all have to get vaccinated to protect against the mutants. Let me say this, natural immunity from the original COVID-19 infection, of which we have many mutants already in the United States. We've had mutants over the entire course of time, dozens of them. That the natural immunity is both durable and complete. And there is not a credible case that I'm aware of where someone had a severe reinfection with either any form of COVID-19 or a mutant strain that resulted in two terrible things, like a hospitalization in April and going on the ventilator and going back on the ventilator in September. It hasn't happened, and it's a false narrative. I think it's wrong because it's keeping people in fear. I mean, what's the purpose of getting through the infection or purpose of getting the vaccination if we're just going to stay in fear in perpetuity?
I got to ask you an important question that I've had listeners ask me to see if we get an answer. Let's say somebody, and they've got the vaccine done now. They had the first and then I guess the second shot. I guess you got to have two shots from what I understand. With those two shots, I believe there's a period of time. What I'm hearing from many experts is there's a series of months have to go by. If you've gotten by the initial stage and there's not hopefully a death report that you died from it, there's still a lot of other conditions that might, other diseases or problems or injuries that might happen to you. But those are not going to really surface until, what is it, 6, 7, 8 months or something later? Is that right or wrong?
Well, we simply don't know. We know besides death, we know that there can be severe what's called anaphylactoid reactions to the polyethylene glycol, which is in the Moderna and the Pfizer vaccine. It's not going to be in the J&J vaccine. Oh. We know that can occur, and that's led to thousands of hospitalizations. That when people get the vaccine, they have to wait for an hour during observation, and the team has to be ready to resuscitate them if it happens. We know that in the Moderna and Pfizer trials, it caused a disproportionate and large number of patients with lymph node swelling, which lasts for weeks in the infected side. So I've already had a patient of mine develop very large lymph nodes in the arm and up the into the clavicle region. There's been instructions now that women shouldn't get a mammogram for a year because it can change the appearance of a mammogram. We know that there's been sporadic but imbalanced cases of Bell's palsy, which is a paralysis.
I heard that too. Yeah.
I mean, this is kind of a horrific thing for a vaccine that, again, a doctor's not ordering or having any jurisprudence over.
Wow.
That patients are just, lining up at vaccination sites and signing off on this. and potentially facing these consequences. There's been a couple disturbing deaths of doctors that have really gotten our attention, two of them, one in Florida and then one, I believe, in Tennessee, where it looks like they could have developed a blood disorder. Remember that the vaccine causes the body to make the spike protein, or the little kind of spiky proteins you see on the cartoons of the virus on the surface of the cell. The spike proteins tip off blood clotting and also platelet abnormalities. And so these deaths occur. There's been a couple of relatively famous deaths. One is Hank Aaron. Hank Aaron, famous baseball player, got the vaccine, I want to say, on January 6th.
Yeah.
And had a press release about how good he felt, him and his wife got it. And he was dead on January 17th. Notice that the press was very clever in decoupling those two. So if you read anything about his death on the 17th, nothing links it back to his vaccine on the 6th. It's very clever.
These are all, they've not been really tried and tested and true as what normally would happen in the vaccines. And because there was this big rush and push to get these out into the public, has left it even more precarious, hasn't it?
Well, yeah, I published in The Hill in the summer, I published an op-ed called The Great Gamble of the Vaccine Development. And basically what I said is these are going to be rushed. And the biggest example is Russia. Russia had a very early vaccine.
That's right.
Not right away. They said, listen, we're going to do it. It was rushed in the United States. The FDA criteria for a vaccine is it must have 2 years of safety data. The FDA truncated it to 2 months for these vaccines.
Wow.
And the concern is, now, that given this false narrative about the variants, it's already being discussed that once you take the COVID vaccine, now you're going to be committed to getting updates. You're going to need to get a booster to try to cover variants or what have you. And so there's already a preparation of the population that this is a permanent thing, that once you take the COVID-19 vaccine, it just keeps coming and coming. You need updates, right. Boosters. Etc.
God, I'm running out of time. I feel like we need to be talking for a lot more here. But let me ask you this final quick question here. And this is not one you probably can answer, but I'm going to ask it anyways. I think a lot of people are wondering, what is the date in your mind, you personally, Dr. McCullough, when we won't be talking about COVID in the current tense anymore?
I think realistically, we shouldn't be talking about it by the summer. When I mean summer, I say June or July. We shouldn't be talking about it. I think fundamentally it'll be low level and we can go on with our lives. That's my personal view.
Amen. Hallelujah to that. You heard it right here, Dr. Peter McCullough. I like that. Summer, June, July. So with that hope, here's the thing, people. You got to weigh the odds here. Is it worth the vaccine? And I know a lot of you, some people are really in line for this and want to have it. Others don't. I know it's a very personal decision, and I can't tell you what to do. I can only tell you that I will not be doing it, and I will say that to you because it's the truth. It's the God's honest truth. But you have to make that decision personally yourself if you're willing to gamble that. The good news is what Dr. McCullough says there is a beautiful thing to hear. And you know, friends, this once in 100-year pandemic, and let's hope that's it, and we can put that back away and get on to solving the rest of the problems that the world throws at us, right? Wow. Big thank you to Dr. Peter McCullough. Always, always such a joy to have him on. And really, what a powerful program today. I'll tell you, I feel really juiced and so good to have you with me on the mission, my friends. It's all back at AmericaOutloud.com. Thank you, as always, for joining me on the mission here. It's time to get involved and get loud.